Good evening, it's 7 o'clock on a Friday night again, and time for another edition of Little Atoms with me, Neil Denny. Our guest on tonight's show is the writer Lindsay Hanley. Lindsay Hanley was born in Birmingham in 1976. She moved to London in 1994 to study politics and history at Queen Mary and Westfield College. She writes for The Observer, The Guardian, The Word and The New Statesman. And her first book, Estates, An Intimate History, is published by Granta Books, and it's this book we'll be talking about tonight. Lindsay, thanks very much for agreeing to speak to me today.
Thanks.
So your book, Estates, An Intimate History, it's a mixture of memoir and social history of council estates and council estate residents. Perhaps you could begin by telling us a little bit about your own experience of growing up on an estate.
I think growing up on the estate that I grew up on, which is a big 60s estate called Chantilly Wood, which is kind of tacked onto the edge of Birmingham, I think the kind of the experience of growing up there is really what, you know, is completely the motivation for writing the book. I grew up there kind of in the 80s and 90s and then left home to go to university in London and found myself living on another council estate in the East End of London. And, you know, in the East End, I was living in an inner city estate. And the experience of living on that estate compared with this big kind of dislocating, kind of quite lonely and sparse and very uniform estate where I grew up, I felt like there were a lot of similarities but also a lot of differences between the two experiences. And I found that once I left home and got, you know, got literally a physical distance from the place where I grew up, frankly, I started getting a kind of complex about it, really. But I realised that I was kind of obsessed with council housing, and also noticing for the first time and realising just how different it is physically and sort of socially and geographically, council housing is to kind of the bigger sort of housing stock, the broader housing stock of Britain. Sort of made me quite keen to explore the reasons why, really.
Okay, well, we're going to come back to that, and particularly to that point you just made about the difference between provincial estate and an inner city estate a bit later. But let's just have a look at a bit about the sort of history and the idea behind council estates. I've got here a quotation from a newspaper, which I'm sure when I start reading it you'll be familiar with, which says, "One painful and monotonous round of vice, filth and poverty, huddled in dark cellars, ruined garrets, bare and blackened rooms, reeking with disease and death, and without the means, even if there were the inclination, for the most ordinary observations of decency and cleanliness." Now, of
right.
course,
is that William Booth or something like that?
It's from the Illustrated London News, 1863,
right.
And it's talking about the Old Nickel in
Bethnal
Green.
Yeah, yeah, God,
which
notorious.
Which is the estate that what's called really the first council estate, the Boundary Street estate, was built to replace. But what I think is interesting is, with a slight bit of touching up in editing, that could have been an editorial in the Daily Mail last week.
Oh, good God, yeah.
And what's interesting is how in that piece, and again, probably if it was rewritten in the Daily Mail, the writer manages to completely sort of mix both the conditions of the housing, the conditions of the slums, and the conditions of the people that lived in them as if they were sort of inseparable.
Conflates the two, yeah.
And I basically wanted to ask, as a way into to talking about the sort of history, if that's the situation that we can imagine in council estate being now, what basically went wrong? You know, let's have a bit of a look at the sort of arc that the idea of social housing took from its inception, basically, to now.
Well, as I was researching the book, I realised that that at each kind of stage in the history of council housing, you know, how it sort of came to be a sort of a part of the landscape, the social and the physical landscape of Britain. So I realised that there was a stage pretty much, you know, every sort of 25 years or so where something very different could have happened, and it tended not to happen because of, depending on the times, either political will or lack of political will, basically, to make housing of all kinds, and particularly rented housing, on an equal par with owned housing, with owner-occupied housing. And, you know, the Boundary Estate was built, as so much council housing was, particularly before the Second World War, was built to house sort of the upper end of the working class, really, you know, kind of artisans and clerks and skilled workers who had the money to pay a decent amount of rent, because obviously they had, you know, what passed for mod cons in those days, but certainly from the 30s onwards, council housing had, you know, indoor bathrooms and things like that, and tended to be large and sort of well proportioned, and therefore more expensive than privately rented slum accommodation. And council housing was built in kind of fits and starts, really, but there was an absolutely huge wave of council house building in the 20 years before the war, sort of in the 30s, when I think over a million council houses were built. But they were built in such a way that they basically segregated, and segregated within them as well, the sort of the classes of people who would live in them. So
let me just interrupt you there. That's a really interesting point, I think, because from a distance now, it's easy to make the distinction between, you know, the idea that there is owner-occupied housing, private housing, and there is council housing. And I grew up myself on council estates till I was 11 on two different estates on the outskirts of Leicester.
Oh, right.
And both of those estates were, well, one was a new build, actually. The first one was the sort of 1920s houses that are exactly as you've just described, really, the Boundary Street estate, in that for all of the council estates in Leicester, I think the people that lived on the estate that I grew up on very much considered that they were on one of the, you know, the upper reaches of estates. And my experience is first of all, not like yours growing up on the Woods estate in terms of its sort of, you know, the concretey windblownness, but nowhere near like the experience of people growing up in tower blocks, which we'll sort of come on to. So I think it's interesting that you say there that people, even within the estates, were sort of segregated.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, almost street by street, really, and that kind of all the research points to that happening right up until the point where sort of housing allocation, you know, in the late 70s and from the right to buy period onwards in the 80s, housing allocation became more about literal need rather than sort of deservingness or undeservingness sort of thing.
So I mentioned the tower block, and again, when people think of council estates, they'll probably get the image of a sort of 60s modernist sort of tower block. And I'd like to sort of explore the idea of to what extent. I mean, I don't think there's many people now that wouldn't agree with the argument that was a disaster.
Mm.
But to what extent do you think that disaster, the obsession with the tower block, the sort of Mies van der Rohe and Le Corbusier sort of machines for living in, that the architects sort of foisted upon people, to what extent that itself is sort of responsible for the low opinion of the very concept of sort of social housing that sort of existed afterwards?
Yeah, well, I think it had a lot to do with it, really, because the really kind of upsetting thing that you find again and again and again when you read about people's experiences moving out to council housing, especially that kind of sort of part prefabricated kind of system built council housing, is that people had almost invariably moved from really awful, cramped, soggy, damp, nasty living conditions, and were moved to what they considered to be palaces, huge houses or flats with you know, hot running water, indoor bathrooms, central heating. All the kids had a room each, you know, or no more than a couple of kids to each room. There was something in the execution, particularly of those kind of like later throw them up quickly kind of estates, that there was something in their execution and their layout, and also the lack of maintenance in terms of lifts and windows and things like that, that just made the physical fabric of these buildings and thereby kind of following on the kind of social fabric fall away really, really quickly. And that's the saddest thing about it, really, because they could have been very different, and the types of housing that was built could have been very different, because sort of shortly after the war, there was a massive, massive demand for housing. And there was pretty much a kind of, by Labour and the Tories, really, successive sets of governments, there was an acceptance that there had to be a lot of rented, you know, council rented housing to be built alongside the kind of the growth in privately built and owned housing after the war. But it really quite quickly, particularly in the 60s, became a sort of numbers game. And Keith Joseph, the housing minister in the early 60s, he was keen to have this subsidy where any council building over six stories would receive a subsidy for each subsequent floor that they built. So the higher the better, really. And this idea of a subsidy for heights. And, you know, Keith Joseph, you said he used to go to bed at night counting the number of units, you know, physically the number of units that he'd managed to build that day, like he counted, like you would count sheep. And so when it becomes this kind of, you know, almost regarding housing as kind of a sort of an offshoot of sort of almost container shipping.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, with no regard to the people or the wishes of the people that are going to actually
exactly,
live in the place.
Exactly, exactly. And endless surveys conducted before and after the war all brought back the same results, which is that people didn't want to live in flats. They wanted houses. And yet increasingly flats were what they got, because it became a numbers game, and it became this kind of quantity over quality issue as well.
Well, just going back a minute, you mentioned the idea of the houses that were replaced by the flats, and there's now almost seems like sort of hindsight received wisdom that it would have been better to have renovated the houses, the streets of terraced houses that existed, rather than raising them and building tower blocks. But I was quite surprised in reading your book to see that you know, they knew that at the time.
Yeah,
it's quite shocking that was known at the time, but for whatever reason, because they wanted to impose some sort of vision, or because of, you know, deals with the construction companies or whatever, it was decided to build the blocks.
Yeah. I mean, it was a mixture of all those sorts of things, you know, kind of political expediency and sort of, you know, architects sort of very much enthralled to the fact that, you know, because of the bombing during the war, they had these great big huge open spaces that they could sort of not play around with, but kind of remake cities in this kind of clean, orderly form, you know. And there was this assumption that these cramped terrace houses, that they were the past, you know, that they represented the past. And there was too much focus placed on the actual physical houses and the kind of very sort of Industrial Revolution kind of throwback sense that this kind of terraced housing gave, rather than the really sort of close-knit social networks that have been built up.
But I mean, interestingly, you mentioned again that the idea that time and time again people say that they want to live in houses, they don't want to live in flats.
Uh-huh.
There's, I mean, terraced housing didn't have gardens. It had sort of,
of course,
yards,
yeah,
and things. There's a sort of quite a British idea of the suburbs, of people in comparison to most cities in Europe, for instance. Most cities in Europe, people live in apartments, and
and
in the UK, people are much more keen on the idea of gardens, and it seems like in some respects it was almost a missed opportunity to, and it's a terrible word, but sort of educate people into the idea of city living in terms of apartments, just because they were so shoddy. I wonder if the flats had been built well in the first place, things might have been different.
Oh, I don't know, because, you know, not all of them were shoddy, you know. I mean, this is a thing. You know, I mean, as early as kind of the mid-30s, you know, a lot of the kind of modernist ideas of sort of communal living and, you know, broadly communal living and of flat, you know, European-style flat living were sort of being established over here, because there was Kensal House in northwest London that was built by Maxwell Fry in the late 30s, and this had a communal laundry, a communal nursery, a communal gardens. Everybody lived in flats, and they were beautifully built. You know, they were, you know, they had light hitting them at certain times of day. You know, they were spacious. They had everything going for them, but they still fell prey to exactly the same problems of people feeling very, after a short honeymoon period, people beginning to feel very kind of isolated and alienated in them. And then, you know, the physical decline. The physical decline and the social decline seems to happen in a kind of bat and ball kind of spiral sort of thing. You know, one leads to the other, and then the other, you know, and then they sort of begin to affect each other sort of thing in a negative way.
One of the key points in the sort of decline of, I suppose, social acceptability of council housing was the Margaret Thatcher's right to buy, where houses, you know, tenants were given vast discounts on their houses, and yeah. It seems that going away from the idea of the sort of statist idea of social housing,
yeah,
I find little to disagree with in this policy, the idea of sort of enabling people to become sort of property owning and to that little bit of social movement. It seems
absolutely
a good idea, but
where
did the policy of not allowing councils to plough the money back into social housing? Because it seems if you allowed tenants to buy their house, but built others so that the other people that were coming up could live in those ones, which they could eventually buy, and so on and so forth. It seems a far better idea. So where does this idea come from of just stopping? It just seems insane.
Oh, well, it was absolutely politically motivated. I mean, the fact was, is, you know, areas with concentrations of council housing tended to vote Labour. You know, this was introduced by the Tories. They wanted blocks of Labour, you know, concentrated blocks of Labour voting to be broken up, giving people, you know, generally better off working class people the chance to buy their house, was basically putting a vote in their pocket every time, and broke up these large Labour voting areas. And if you were to keep giving councils power, you know, I mean, the Tories at that time, you know, the Thatcherite Tories hated local authorities having power. So they didn't want councils to have the power that came from being able to do what they wanted with the revenue from right to buy sales. And they also didn't want this kind of swathe of Labour voting housing stock to be replaced and replenished. They actually wanted it to be reduced to a rump, because, you know, A, they wanted people to kind of, you know, sink or swim on very individualistic terms. And also, you know, for these reasons, they wanted council housing stock to stop being this kind of, you know, this kind of almost guarantee of a Labour vote in areas where they could quite easily siphon a few Tory votes off. You know?
But what's interesting about that is the areas where, you know, vast areas of the country where people bought their properties became, you know, the Thatcherite revolution was born on the back of working class Tory voters, basically.
Oh, yeah,
it seems a shame that they, you know, such what seems like actually quite a forward thinking social policy should be sort of ruined just on those sort of partisan lines, really.
Well, that's exactly what happened. You know, I mean, it could have been, you know, if the housing had been replaced, then it could have been, you know, it could have been, if not progressive, then it could, you know, it could easily not have been as damaging to the idea of council housing forming a very important and sort of an equal and integral part of the housing stock. Could have continued to kind of coexist with private housing rather than being reduced to this, you know, sort of extremely kind of marginalised status.
I want to go back to something you spoke briefly about at the beginning, this idea about the difference between sort of say an inner city London or presumably an inner city Manchester or something, council housing, and the same thing on the edge of a provincial city. What do you think the essential differences are?
Well, so I suppose size is one thing. You know, I mean, you physically can't have you know, absolutely enormous estates in inner cities. They tend to be comprising a few hundred houses or flats rather than thousands upon thousands over an area, you know, over a kind of green belt area. It's funny, I think it's always the similarities that strike me more than the differences, really, which are the fact that council housing almost invariably, or social housing almost invariably, looks completely different to private housing. It's almost something pointed about it. This is social housing, this is special housing, this is for people who can't afford their own house.
And this is again this is a late development, though, isn't it? Because again, the housing that was built in the 20s, go back to, you know, the estate that I grew up on, it was in that sort of 1920s English vernacular sort of
kind of look,
almost like arts and craftsy, you know, the sort of workers' cottage type look. So again, this is something that's very much comes from
a sort of post-war development.
Yeah, and I wonder if that's just an unhappy coincidence, basically, in that there was a vision for social housing that had everything to do with modernism, and that's why it looks different, not because they wanted council housing to stand out.
Well, not necessarily, because you know, council housing was still built in concentrations. You know, in the 20s and 30s, it was still built in concentrations. And
sure.
It didn't necessarily always have lower specifications. And certainly in terms of size, council houses were often bigger because there were legal requirements for size, you know, where with speculatively built private housing, there weren't those kind of space, minimum space standards. But in terms of, I mean, you know, if you look at sort of 20s and 30s council housing and private housing of a piece, then the specifications are slightly different, and council housing from that area is almost always plainer and has smaller windows because it's cheaper, because bigger windows are more expensive, and, you know, the look is generally just that bit much plainer. But, yeah, it became really, really pronounced later on, yeah.
One other thing I want to talk about, we can't really talk about the history of estates without talking about the history of the people that inhabit those estates.
Yeah.
And leaving aside the sort of inner city or, you know, more urban London type estates, going back to the more provincial. Last week, Julian Bugini was on the show.
Oh,
and
right,
we talked very briefly about his book, Welcome to Every Town.
Yeah.
Which, although not essentially about people on council estates, it's very much about this concept that seems to have come about recently of the sort of the white working class.
Ooh, yeah.
As a, you know, a distinct social grouping,
yeah.
Which I'm very uncomfortable with,
oh,
with this
God,
idea.
So what's
your take on that?
I think it's completely heinous. It's funny, I've met Julian Bugini a couple of times, and, you know, we've got on really, really well, but I think he does kind of believe kind of ethnographically in this idea of a white working class, and you know, I just completely reject it. You know, the fact is there are working class people who are white. They don't constitute a separate group to working class people who aren't white. They don't have separate economic and social interests, and to say that white working class people do, you know, and form this kind of monolithic group is, you know, it's condescending, it plays into the hands of the right, it's kind of almost, you know, it creates conditions in which, you know, kind of self-pity and, you know, kind of self-righteousness and little Englandism can flourish. You know, I just can't stand it, basically.
Well,
you know, and I come from a place where, you know, 97% of the people are white. And I would say 100% are working class. But, you know, I mean, if you're going to say, you know, there is a white working class, then where does that leave the working class people who I also grew up alongside who aren't white? You know, it's just completely, it's completely wrong.
Well, it seems it's almost come, you know, the way we've got to that position, which, as somebody who has, you know, minor socialist leanings that have always been internationalist, I find this quite surprising myself. And although it's very fashionable at the moment among circles of the right, for instance, to mock the idea of divide the idea of multiculturalism, it does seem that if you're going to go around the business of bracketing certain groups of people as communities, then inevitably the ones that you're not talking about are going to be bracketed as communities as well.
Oh, good God, yeah.
And it seems like, you know, it's been mentioned many times before, of course, but, you know, the BNP, for instance, are very, very cleverly capitalised on this, which is, I'm sure, a side effect that the sort of liberal intelligentsia did not really foresee happening.
Well, I mean, it's just, it's an absolute indictment of the general, incredibly monolithic middle classness of the media, that they can create this group and not really realise what they're doing by doing that. You know, like just after the local council elections in May, there was a newspaper column in one of the papers, which I won't name, one of the broadsheet-style newspapers, which I won't name, that said, BNP votes are a cry of white working class anguish. And I just thought, oh, my God. You're basically saying, if you're working class and you're white, you've got a golden ticket that excuses you from the hideous fact of voting for the BNP. You wouldn't let anybody else off the hook for voting BNP. Why would you create this group and then say, oh, well, it's, you know, oh, well, we can explain it, we can excuse it if they vote for the BNP?
But then that works both ways, because the white working class if we're going to use that term, can be vilified as this group of people that will vote for the BNP. It's like it's, you know, that they're almost untouchable because these are the opinions they have. You know, any time you see a group of people as a sort of monolithic block like that, it's easy to imbue them with certain motives that you want them to have yourself, I suppose.
Yeah. No. I mean, it's a really awful development, and I think it's got to try and be kind of nipped in the bud. And it wasn't helped at all by that BBC season that was recently on the White season, you know, which kind of basically regarded economically marginal white people as kind of, you know, something you could look at as though you're in a zoo, you know.
No, absolutely, I agree. And we're actually out of time. We've been talking for nearly half an hour.
Oh, crumb, sorry.
Lindsay, thanks very much for appearing on the show.
Oh, thank you.